Hello, I'm Lenore Mudu. Welcome to Health Chat. Louisiana health authorities on Monday reported the first human death in the United States linked to the H5N1 bird flu, while noting the patient had underlying medical conditions and that general risks to the public remained low. The patient, aged over 65, had been hospitalized in the southern state since at least mid-December, when the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, announced it as the country's first serious case of human infection from the H5N1 virus. Louisiana Department of Health said the patient had contracted the virus after exposure to a combination of a non-commercial backyard flock and wild birds, but had detected no further H5N1 infections nor evidence of person-to-person transmission in the state. The World Health Organization has recorded over 950 bird flu cases in humans since 2003 in 24 countries, including a large number in China and Vietnam. France has detected its first cases of new mpox virus, according to the health ministry. A case of the clade 1B variant was confirmed in the Western Brittany region, and the recommended oversight measures have been implemented, the ministry said in a statement. Mpox, previously known as monkeypox, is caused by a virus transmitted to humans by infected animals, but can also be passed from human to human through close physical contact. The WHO declared an emergency over the virus in August and renewed it on November 22nd following an outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. France's health ministry says the case concerned a person who had not traveled to Central Africa. The new year is here, and with it comes a wave of hopes, aspirations, and fresh beginnings. Experts say physical activity is one of the most popular New Year's resolutions as people aim to improve their health and well-being. In the Ivorian economic capital, Abidjan, exercising is an activity embraced by many, regardless of age. More and more seniors are taking up physical activities to stay in shape.
7 a.m. and Abidjan is slowly waking up. But Jean Chisot isn't one to stay in bed. Three times a week, this lively 65-year-old goes for a morning jog. At a steady pace, he covers nearly 20 kilometers.
I used to feel heavy. When I walked, I'd be out of breath and tired. But since I started exercising, I don't have those problems anymore. Now I walk with ease, no worries, no trouble.
For Marie, Joseph, and Madeleine, giving up is not an option. Both women, nearly 70, know the benefits of sports and regularly work out at a gym.
You know, seniors are prone to cardiovascular diseases. We are advised to exercise, and that's what we are doing. It helps us a lot. I have noticed that with exercise, I have lost weight.
Stretching, warm-ups, strength training. On this day, nothing is skipped. With their coach, Madeleine and Marie-Joseph were clear, no special treatment because of their age.
People often say to me, with your white hair, how can you still exercise? I tell them, my father was over 90 and still exercised. Even my mother, now over 100, insists on doing her own exercises, saying it keeps her feeling good.
Gym membership can be expensive and not affordable for everyone. To stay fit, Amos and Antoine prefer working out at home.
As you can see, from head to toe, you can work out your entire body without spending a fortune. You can achieve nearly the same results by doing these exercises. Whilst illness can happen, you can prevent many by taking these precautions.
Antoine, an 80-year-old in great health, follows his coach's instructions from Canada through a fitness program tailored to seniors, all from the comfort of his home.
Exercising gives me a sense of well-being. At 80, I can still move with ease and breathe well. I also have my smartwatch that tracks my heart rate and blood pressure. While exercising, I monitor my vitals to avoid any surprises.
According to the World Health Organization, 3 to 5 million people die each year globally due to physical inactivity. The statistics are a major motivation to Abidjan's silver-haired athletes. For Yassine Sio in Abidjan, I'm Vincent Macquarie, VOA News.
We ask the listeners to share their thoughts, resolutions, and health outlook for the year. From personal wellness goals to collective dreams for stronger communities, here are some reactions from Rwanda, Tanzania, and Nigeria.
For 2025, I'm hoping that I would be more focused on my mental health. And this one does not just start from the mental well-being. I just need to look at how I'll prioritize my time and give myself enough time to rest.
I stand big on matters of fitness. When I'm talking about fitness, I mean like the whole program itself, keeping fit, working out, and ensuring that I do exercise almost on a daily, because that is how I keep myself fit, and that is how I tend to shy away from other sickness.
I'm planning to improve on my diet by incorporating boiled foods more than fried or oily foods and spices.
Yes, I've been trying my best to work on my body, doing some exercises in 2024. I interact with students as an educationist, and at times I find myself in circumstances that require me to run, you know, with students and so on. So I want to continue with that and even work and intensify on the same.
Quite frankly, in 2025, I have so many plans on my health resolutions. First of all, I'm going to have a better diet so that I will eat food that will make me healthier. And secondly, I'm going to have more regular exercise so I will keep myself fit.
Because of the chronic disease that affecting the community, I will pay more attention on exercise. And number two, diet. I will try to improve my diet.
I have to change the doctors I'm seeing for my medical checkup because I have other problems which was not solved during 2024.
Okay, my health resolution is probably how to maybe improve my health through dietary management. Because in advanced countries now, in everybody that is science-oriented, we are trying to see how we can use our diet to improve our health condition.
People turn to alcohol for various reasons, to celebrate, socialize, commiserate, or drown their sorrows. Experts say while it may seem harmless to have a few extra drinks, binge drinking can lead to uncomfortable hangovers that interfere with daily life and can cause long-term harm. Hangovers are characterized by headaches, nausea, fatigue, and sensitivity to light and sound. The symptoms can significantly disrupt people's overall well-being. Juma Majanga reports from Nairobi, Kenya.
The Roka Lounge Bar and Restaurant in Nairobi's Utawala Estate is packed with revelers. David Kinoti says he is out to enjoy drinks with his friends.
We have to drink. Sometimes this life we have nowadays, we have to take a tips so that we can survive. This world is not very easy. So we take tips so that we can survive. Yes, especially the economy of Ruto. We have to take tips so that we can survive.
Kinoti admits that after a night of drinking, he suffers from hangovers.
Hangover, it's very obvious. But the following day, you feel like you don't feel to wake up. You don't feel like doing anything. You just feel like relaxing, like you're sleeping.
Dr. Kingi Mochache is a psychiatrist working with Psych Care Medical Center in Nairobi. She explains how hangovers occur as the body tries to process alcohol.
You remember in chemistry, there are stages of how you break down something, eh? So when alcohol is being broken down, there's something here in the middle called acetaldehyde. That thing is the one that after that has to wait in a certain level for the next metabolism. This is the thing that causes hangover. It feels very bad. It makes someone feel nauseous, vomiting, feel very bad. So the people who accumulate a lot of acetaldehyde, it's because the next step delays, it's slower, and then they have a harder time.
Dr. Mochachi says alcohol dehydrates the body by increasing the production of urine, which can lead to symptoms like dry mouth and dizziness. It disrupts sleep patterns, leaving individuals feeling tired and irritable. She says hangovers also affect people's mental performance.
Of course, you're not going to be of sound mind and you're going to be unwell. So it depends on your job. And if your job is sensitive, I would say maybe your manager should not allow you to work. You should just take either a leave day or something so that you're in the right frame of mind. People who, you know, like pilots, doctors, there are these careers where you really need to be concentrating and in a good state of health. Don't endanger other people's lives because of a hangover.
Experts say there is no medical remedy for hangovers, and recovering from them may vary from one person to another. Kinoti says solutions such as rehydration or getting extra sleep works for him.
Take soup and fruits. They help a lot. Yes, to remove hangovers. And you'll be very sober to go to work.
A 2022 survey by Kenya's National Authority for the Campaign Against Alcohol and Drug Abuse, NACADA, showed alcohol use prevalence at 44.5% among public sector employees and at 30% among the general public. As the festive season kicks in, Dr. Kingi urges responsible drinking.
Drink responsibly. There is the criteria of how to drink responsibly if you must. Ideally, look for other ways to have fun. As I said, there is a formula on how to drink. Understand yourself. Don't do reckless drinking and driving, operating machinery, getting to a level of being completely drunk. Avoid that.
Medical experts say hangover can significantly impact personal and public health by causing decreased productivity at work due to fatigue and increased risk of accidents and injuries from poor coordination due to impaired cognitive function, and puts potential strain on healthcare systems due to individuals seeking relief for hangover symptoms. Juma Majanga, VOA Africa, Nairobi.
Dr. Isaac Kiduma is Assistant Managing Director of Afya Partners Initiative in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. He discusses the causes and challenges of binge drinking, a pattern of excessive alcohol consumption that poses significant health risks, and shares critical tips on drinking responsibly.
When we talk about binge drinking, is the excessive alcohol intake within a shorter period of time that is exacerbated by certain motives. For instance, during holiday, people prefer to take large amount of alcohol because of cultural norms and the other factors that are associated with the holidays. But when we talk about alcoholism, this is the disease, the excessive intake of alcohol frequently, regularly. Sometimes you find this person has a strong cravings or dependence on alcohol. So binge, it happens once due to certain motives, but alcoholism is there. A person is, and it is a disease. So a person will take alcohol daily, and despite the consequences that are facing these persons. You know, all toxins have been metabolized in the liver. So once a person is drinking a large amount of alcohol, the liver becomes overwhelmed. That's number one. But number two, you know, a person who is taking alcohol tends to urinate frequently, right? So the severe dehydration also can lead a person to have a severe hangover. But apart from that, sometimes can lead to electrolyte imbalances and the blood sugar, which are all these are the things that can contribute to severe hangovers. Apart from resting, a person should ensure that, because this results to dehydration, a person should ensure that he's well rehydrated. So he's consuming enough amount of water that can replace that one that has been lost. It's very difficult to avoid binge drinking, but we can reduce or we can find other activities that can be done during the whole day. For instance, we can prefer traveling, playing games instead of taking alcohol. But apart from that, also drinking together with the water. You know, you take half glass of alcohol or half glass of beer, and you take half glass of water. This will regulate the amount of the alcohol a person is taking. Binge drinking is a public health issue because it leads to health issues, accidents, and sometimes injuries. So we need to educate the people on drinking responsibly during the holiday, number one. Number two, finding a way of moderating these big companies, like beer companies. You know, during the holidays, the time where they advertise their products, and sometimes they have new products for the holidays. You know, finding a way that these advertisements won't make people hype to go for excessive drinking.
That was Dr. Isaac Kiduma, Assisting Managing Director of Afya Partners Initiative in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Health Chat. Researchers in France say they have found a way to treat strokes with greater precision and less toxicity of current treatments. Take a listen.
Researchers in France have synthesized particles called physiomic that can identify and destroy the tiny blood clots responsible for strokes with greater precision and less toxicity than the current process.
Grâce à l'agent de contraste.
So, thanks to the contrast agent, we were able to set up a collaboration with the pharmaceutical company CSL Behring, as well as Inserm Transfer, to develop this diagnostic tool and turn it into a theranostic tool. In other words, it will both diagnose and make visible the microclots, and at the same time, allow them to break down and restore blood flow in patients.
We made a magnetic and biodegradable contrast agent. The biodegradable properties are prerequisite for the contrast agent. Once injected into the body, to be completely metabolized and not cause toxic effects. Magnetic properties enable a signal to be obtained in magnetic resonance imaging. An ischemic stroke is caused by a clot migrating from the carotid artery and blocking the blood supply to the brain. We can now see large clots on MRI. On the other hand, we don't currently know how to detect the smaller clots that lodge in microcirculation. Our contrast agent will never have any toxic effects because it uses only materials that are already present in the body. In this test tube, we have our contrast agent, which consists of iron oxide and polydopamine microplastics. These microplastics can be injected into the bloodstream, and with their polydopamine coating, they will bind to the microclot. Once they have attached themselves to the microclot, because they have magnetic properties, they can be seen in an MRI.
So there are currently just over 160 to 170 people working together on neurovascular diseases, understanding the mechanism of action and trying to develop new therapeutic and diagnostic strategies, mainly for strokes. So it's an academic research center, but it's also associated with private structures. Four startups from the laboratory are working with us.
Dr. Frank Minja is a diagnostic radiologist at Emory Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia, and president of RoadToIR.org, an organization that provides radiology training in East Africa. It discusses how medical experts in the diaspora can impact Africa's health system.
For some years now, we have been involved in actually training programs, setting up training programs, because there is a very huge lack of radiologists across the continent. Specifically, many countries in sub-Saharan Africa have one radiologist for a population of about 1 million people. That is the average number across the 54 countries in Africa. So to close that gap, we've been working very hard in East Africa to establish training programs, specifically in radiology, because you can't buy radiologists. You have to train your own radiologists. And basically, if you don't have our own training programs, that is really where the problem begins.
When we talk about the health system, of course, the workforce is critical. And that's where you're coming with the training of radiologists in East Africa. Tell us about what it takes to be able to implement such a program.
Yes, so it takes a village. There are many, many people actually involved in our training program. Specifically, I'm talking about the Road to IR initiative. And this began in 2017, 2018, when we were invited to Tanzania to help establish an interventional radiology service at the National Hospital. And at that time, the National Hospital had good equipment. We had a good CT scan. We had a good ultrasound. Obviously, no shortage of patients. And also had a lot of eager residents, meaning trainees, who were willing to learn the skill. The only thing we do not have were actually skilled practitioners. So given our networks in the United States, we organized those teams to go on a regular basis to provide that training in Tanzania specifically. So we established a curriculum at the university in Dar es Salaam, Muhimbili University, and that works with the Muhimbili National Hospital. And so between those two, we have a curriculum and we have a good network of physicians who go on a regular basis. And up to now, we've been able to graduate 13 interventional radiology specialists who are working in Tanzania, Rwanda, and Nigeria.
Why is radiology an important aspect of the big picture of medicine when we talk about improving health system? Radiology seems to be a field that we don't hear a lot about.
Absolutely. So in modern medicine, as a matter of fact, I would say any hospital you go to in the United States, it will be impossible for you to not be touched by radiology, whether it's an X-ray, whether it's an ultrasound, whether it's a CT scan, whether it's an MRI scan. And essentially, this is modern medical imaging. And previously, many physicians will palpate you and feel your body to kind of like, you know, try to determine what's happening inside your body. But now with the new technologies, we're able to see inside the body and actually see and be able to diagnose. And that is really what the radiologist does. We interpret those medical images to see what's happening. Most people will probably encounter this during pregnancy when they go and see their baby. And so basically, that is probably the easiest way to kind of explain it. Or if you have a fracture, many people have a sense of like they'll get an X-ray to see whether their bone is fractured. But again, as we are having more and more serious diseases, for example, cancer, for example, stroke, and so forth, these powerful technologies of CT scan and MRI are very important in helping diagnose. And just one further point I want to make is that many governments are purchasing the machines. Right, so they're purchasing the CT scan, they're purchasing the MRI, they're purchasing the ultrasound, except they're not purchasing who's actually going to read those images when they're produced. So that's where the radiologist comes in. So you will get a CT scan, you will get an MRI scan, but it doesn't come with a radiologist who's actually going to interpret the images. So that's where we come in to try to bridge that gap of making sure specialists are interpreting the images correctly and serving the surgeons, the internal medicine doctors, the obstetricians, and so forth.
What do you think is the role of the diaspora medical expertise in terms of building and strengthening Africa's health system?
So I feel that the role of the African diaspora in helping to bridge these gaps in a specialty care is really to provide training, but also to be a bridge, because many of us who maintain contacts with our native countries in Africa understand the local culture, understand the local politics and dynamics. And so we are able to use that knowledge to orient our counterparts who may not necessarily be from the continent. And so we serve that cultural ambassador role, but also we serve as advocates because of where we are. I don't think even if all of the African diaspora moved to Africa, that would necessarily solve the problem. So that is not really the issue, but there are many, many of our colleagues in America, North America, specifically United States and Canada, who are willing to go on these short trips to Tanzania or elsewhere on the continent to assist in this mission to train our physicians on the continent. And again, it's really exciting because from a sustainability perspective, we already see that as you train our local physicians in the local environment, one, our trainers now, they become their own specialists, but also our patients benefit directly from that service. So I think there's a big role for the diaspora to play. And I think I can't emphasize that we should take advantage that many of us who came as first generation are no longer, quote unquote, native Tanzanians. And many of us never feel that we will be fully American. So we kind of live in this in-between state, but that in-between state allows you to kind of be a bridge between the two cultures and hopefully benefit the populations are still on the continent.
To you, where are the urgencies in terms of improving the health system in general?
I would say lack of specialists by far is the most challenging. And I will go further to say that many countries do not even have a training program. So many times you'll hear that, you know, the problem is brain drain. The problem is lack of, you know, people staying on the continent. But I really feel the major lack is actually lack of training programs because I believe there's no shortage of trainees. So we have to work very hard to produce and create those opportunities on the continent, because really the alternative is to send them to the United States, to Canada, to Europe for training. And I'm a perfect example. It's highly unlikely that you're going to return to the continent after spending 10, 15 years getting your education. So I think one way to address both the shortage in specialists and also help to address the issue of brain drain is to create training opportunities on the ground. And in our experience, as you create training opportunities on the ground, the hospitals also tend to invest in those facilities as well, because they can actually see that our clinicians, as they're gaining more skills, they can actually use better equipment and so forth. And so that has been true for us for intervention radiology, neuroradiology, and now women's imaging. So I think if you're doing the work in the country, it tends to be more supported. And many times, if you go to train abroad and you come back 5 years later and you find the system is just as you left it, guess what? Now you have to like build the system from the ground. But if you're training within that environment, chances are you actually have to contend with all of the challenges. And usually there will be more investment as well.
Dr. Frank Minja, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. Frank Minja, Diagnostic Radiology at Emory Hospital in Atlanta. In today's digital age, parents face the daunting challenge of navigating their children's screen time amidst the rapid advancement of technology. With the rapid growth of internet access, smartphones, and social media, many African parents are becoming stricter with their children in an effort to forestall the adverse effects of excessive screen time on their children's development and overall well-being. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
Helen Atieno, 38, a mother of one, is one of millions of parents who are strict when it comes to entering the vast, uncharted territories of the internet and technology.
When it's the phone, only 1 hour, because she uses the phone only when the homeworks are given there. But for the television, I can't say the hours, because sometimes I'm not in the house. So I think with the television going to YouTube, maybe she can watch even more than 2 hours.
The World Health Organization recommends no screen time for children under the age of 2 and 1 hour or less for children between the ages of 2 and 5. For children 6 and older, parents are urged to monitor and limit the shows and games they play to keep them safe. As technology advances rapidly, many parents feel that raising kids is becoming more challenging because of social media and smartphones. Health experts warn that too much screen time can cause anxiety, depression, poor mental health, sleep problems, and issues with social and emotional development among children. Some parents notice these adverse effects on their children and within their communities.
Well, the disadvantages of having the internet is it is addictive in that when the child wakes up in the morning, then they tend to, you know, that's the first thing they think about.
For some, the internet is really helpful. They learn a lot, but for some, they become so dull. So I think there should be a balance.
Studies show that too much screen time can negatively affect children's development, including their communication and problem-solving skills. Even though Atieno's child may have already passed those early stages, Atieno is still very strict and encourages her to study hard for a brighter future. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. Thank you all for joining us, and thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Linor Mundu in Washington, with producer Mokbilia Barrow. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.